The following podcast is a proud member of the Miniatures Wargaming Union. For the latest wargaming news and other podcasts, check out mwunion.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Draw Podcast. You're tuning into episode 42 for Tuesday, April 10th, 2008. I'm your host, Steve Boyce, and joining me in the Draw Podcast today is Chris Weigel.
Hello everyone, how you doing?
And Tim Gunther.
How's it going?
Alright, in today's episode, we got news from the front lines, as always. You and the show, we're going to be talking about the Lizardmen Skinks, personal favorite. We also have some listener feedback that we're going to try to catch up on. And also we have something a little special at the end of the show, but we'll get to that a bit later. But first and foremost, let's get right into things. We're going to start off with news from the front lines. All right, so probably the biggest news that just happened recently, and something that made us all very, very, very happy. THQ held their Gamers Day event last week, and they announced a sequel to a particular game that we very, very much love, and that would be Dawn of War 2. Now, they're still kind of keeping things under wraps. They did reveal some information upon it. Some gorgeous screenshots were released on the game, and a pretty awesome teaser trailer of a space marine with a thunder hammer bashing the shit out of an orc skull. So, like, what more can you ask for? But, yeah, so Dawn of War 2 is shaping up to be something really awesome. We all pretty much knew the game was coming. The game was in development. Was it right after the first Dawn of War?
Something about 6 months before one expansion, I think.
Yeah, I think it was
6 months before Winter Assault.
Something like that.
Yeah, and the game uses the same engine that powered Company of Heroes, so it's a, like I said, absolutely gorgeous looking game. It's an enhanced version of that engine.
Yeah.
So the game looks spectacular and looks more,
not only
like
that,
Warhammer
2.0.
The physics shit on there, and way it looks, not necessarily how good it looks, but just the way it looks, should be really awesome.
Absolutely. They're kind of just going through all the things. We're not going to read off everything that they talked about, because there's a whole lot, and again, not all of this is confirmed, but the main things that were confirmed is cooperative campaign, so the single-player campaign can be played entirely through co-op with another person. So, and that's a big feat, especially for an RTS game. So very, very few do that.
Yeah, that's,
if any at all.
That sounds really cool. Done the right way, I think that would be one of the major, one of the real major things about Dawn of War 2 is being able to, basically single-player co-op, kind of like a multiplayer single-player thing.
Yeah, yeah. But, and also, too, like, they're revealing things about units and stuff like that. So far, the only races that have been revealed are the orcs and the space marines. Obviously, probably the two main races that will be shown.
Yeah.
But, and then everyone is going on a binge about Tyranids. We know, we hear it enough.
I know, I commented on it, and people took it the wrong way, so I apologize if you were
actually
offended.
Actually, even though, like, the orcs are one of the, for at least, like, space orcs are one of the more iconic races for 40K, I wish instead of the orcs they would put in there the Tyranids, just because they didn't have them in the last game. But I think they work just as well as the orcs, though. I mean, the orcs are great and everything, but for the second game, they could work just as well for an expansion. But actually, the guys I'm waiting for are the Imperial Guard. just because with the engine that they're using, if you've seen the expansion for Company of Heroes, the one of the not races but factions can dig trenches and do all these and things like that, just defensive stuff. And for the Imperial Guard, that would just be mind-blowingly awesome, I think.
Yeah. And like I said, because it's using that same engine, all this stuff like cover mechanics, like one of the screenshots, for example, was showing that off where there's some orcs laying down some fire upon a small squad of Marines that are like ducking behind some rubble and stuff like that.
You don't even have to tell them to do that. They just the AI automatically does it. And even like the things that they hide behind are also destructible. So if you have a tank coming and blowing them up, they're just SOL. So I think that's pretty cool. So there's no impenetrable cover kind of thing or any of that. I just think that's pretty cool on there.
Like I said, they have stated fully destructible environments, which, that'd be pretty awesome.
And you can, like in Company Heroes, you're able to occupy buildings and lay down fire from buildings and stuff like that. So I think that'll be awesome.
Hopefully they do it a bit differently than Company of Heroes, just because Company of Heroes is great and you can occupy buildings and stuff. However, every time you occupy a building, it's kind of generic how they occupy. Everybody has a few sandbags set up in windows, and it's colorized to your team colors. Hopefully they'll do something a bit more interesting on there, just because I don't want to see my guys setting up sandbags every freaking time they're in the building the same way.
Probably won't, unless if it's like a space marine going capturing a building, they're just going to go in there for cover's sake. They're not
it'd be cool if
banners.
One of your guys has a flamer, or what I'm thinking of is like a heavy bolter. Instead, you can zoom in and see your guy prop up his heavy bolter on one of the windowsills or something like that. Instead of sitting out of the building randomly. See, that's what I'm talking about. It can look almost the same, but I'm just how they do it, the mechanics of that, I hope they'll change a little bit. Like if you have a bigger weapon, you prop it up on the windowsill and start blasting away with it like it's a machine gun or whatever.
I think they did it in Company of Heroes as well, I believe.
With the big weaponry?
The large like machine gun stuff like that. It was propped up on a tripod on the windowsill.
Guys
with rifles, obviously, they popped out of the window, but the other guns were just mounted on there.
Yeah, I guess I just have to see that.
The thing I'm worried about is that so far, to me, all the orcs look generic.
Well, yeah, again, but Tim and I were talking about this before. Like, it is so early in game development cycle that it doesn't go until next year. And it was the same thing with the first Dawn of War. And there is going to be variation. They just point us out for the sake of announcements.
Yeah.
But, there will be variation. Like, again, if you saw Dawn of War when it was first announced to what it looks like now, like, when it was released, there was no comparison. Space Marines look completely different. They look better in Dawn of War was released than it was when it was first shown up. It looked kind of weird.
I know.
The same thing with this. Like, it's going to change by final version.
Even the Space Marines for Dawn of War 2 right now look a bit funny just because they're tall, but they're way too thin, making them look really gangly, which really isn't a Space Marine. They're bulky and wide.
Yeah, I think, and also the shoulder pads look a tad off.
Yeah, they look
the trimming on there seems a bit odd. But again, like there's still a year till this game comes out. Let's not nitpick about it until it's actually out. But from what we've seen so far, and it's so early in development, but the game looks gorgeous. Like the environments, everything, the effects.
Yes.
Just everything about it looks really awesome, and it's probably like the best looking real-time strategy game so far. Like, even though StarCraft 2 is coming around, it's just the style and everything, and this one it's really awesome.
My favorite picture by far is one of those magazine screens from one of the European magazines that broke the news. Is the Dreadnought the Dreadnought just impaling the orc?
The orc
blood just flying everywhere.
It's just like a fountain of blood.
Which reminds me, the PC Gamer or Games for Windows, whatever magazine was supposed to announce
PC World or whatnot.
Oh no, they said the preview come. Remember that one that said, "Are you ready for a new Dawn?" Had the picture of like the Space Marine or the Shattered Space Marine. That actually comes out tomorrow, doesn't it? Because it doesn't come out... Didn't they say April 10th?
That's true. Oh, yeah. So someone else had the exclusive before them, then.
You know what would be cool? When the Dreadnought punches through people, to have him sit there and spin around with the Fountain of Blood, and then they have just kind of nice little music playing. Wouldn't that be sweet? That would be masterfully awesome.
Yes. But, yeah, that game... And one thing I'm pretty happy about is that the scale is looking a lot better than the original Dawn of War. And that was the one thing I always complained about. So they're not referring to table... So far, they're not referring to tabletop scale. They're going by actual scale. And which Dreadnought seemed to be proper size, you know, like pretty much double size of a Marine.
Except for that tank was a bit small. Looked a bit small in the one picture.
The Predator?
Where
you have the Predator?
And the Predator. It just...
Yeah.
Considering even if you take the armor off the Space Marines, they're still pretty darn bulky, and I don't, like, I think you'd have a lookout, a commander, or not, well, the commander, the ammunition dude, and then the two side gunners, and then the driver, and, like, a whatever, mechanic or something. So that's a fair few guys in there who are basically 7-8 foot tall, huge, muscular dude sitting in that really small tank. It's like, you could make, you don't even may have to make it a lot bigger. Just, it just looks too small compared to the other guy. Yeah. That's the only thing I saw, really, that I didn't, not necessarily like, but that just looked a little out of place.
Yeah.
But, like you said, a lot of freaking time for them to improve.
There's so much time till this comes out.
My favorite thing so far is the pointy beaks. The point.
Yeah, the
I'm so happy about that. I was like, yes.
Which, yeah, that was one thing I noticed as well. They threw them on the assault marines, and that's where they should be. So hopefully we'll see that in like tactical squads.
I remember in Dawn of War 1, there was a mod just to add beakers randomly. And now they're actually in. And I'm like, yes, I don't have to activate this mod anymore. That was a good. It's a good mod. It added variation.
One thing I don't want to be talking too long about this, but just like one thing I'm kind of hoping for as well is I hope they kind of stay true to the rule set based on the tabletop. It's like right now in Dawn of War, if you have a Marine squad, you can pump it full of like 6 rocket launcher or 5 or whatever rocket launchers in there, and realistically, no, like that wouldn't happen. It was, you know, that'd be like a Devastator squad. But I hope they have the options, you know, make it more, I guess you can make it more balanced that way. Have like the one heavy weapons guy in a squad and perhaps expand the options to like a plasma cannon, which was never even in Dawn of War. And perhaps like a las cannon per squad and stuff like that. So I think spacing out your options like that would be pretty cool.
If you played...
it's more tactile.
If you played Company of Heroes... They have that same kind of mechanic in there.
Yeah, that's the thing.
But
and
also,
yeah, it's realistic.
Considering you only can have apparently 6 Space Marine squads, I don't know why they wouldn't do that and add some of the really big weapons. Just because if you only have 6 Space Marine squads, they have to be really freaking powerful and stuff, which is also cool considering they're really freaking powerful anyway.
Again, that might be for campaign, or we'll see when it comes out. Like, they haven't listed if that was confirmed or not, but E3 is right around the corner, so we'll find out more there. So, also one other thing, just because we're talking about THQ's Game Raiders Day, they lightly touched upon the 40K MMO, and they've stated that, they talked about World of Warcraft and everything like that, and stated that the 40K MMO is many, many years away still, so you probably won't see anything. Probably this year, probably won't see anything. Maybe next year you'll start seeing some screens or something, but just to put that info out there just to give you guys a little update on that.
Yeah, from the tidbit that they did, one of the tidbits that they did give, it sounds kind of cool just because you can go and hunt through or just rummage through Space Hulks, and I'm just like, okay, that's pretty cool.
The thing is, I saw an article recently, and me and Gillies were getting into a huge argument over it. The same THQ is basically saying that World of Warcraft has peaked in its
that's the article I read, actually.
I just to add this in, I agree with that. I think it really has peaked. I mean, My friends are in it, and they even said, like, there's nobody on anymore, and they're on the highest populated server, and there's almost no one there, ever.
But just wait till the friggin' expansion comes out, and then everyone will be on again.
See, this was my argument, because in the expansion, one of the raid groups is Arthas. So once you take out Arthas, what's there left to do? What's left to really do? I mean, their PvP system is, let's face it, it's not that great at all.
Well, that's what it's supposed to revitalize. They have destructible buildings and junk in there, kind of.
And siege and stuff like that. Whatever they got that from.
It has to have an up and then like a climax and then go down, just because the gameplay is so freaking redundant. It's just kind of like, yeah, I played it for 20 minutes and I know everything about it. Yay, let's go do something else.
Please don't send us emails complaining about any of our statements regarding World of Warcraft.
To do one of those Fox things. All material spoken about property of the individual speakers and not necessarily of the drop podcast.
Yes. We'll throw a disclaimer at the end of the show. All comments said by individuals are not representative of the Miniatures Wargaming Union. Copyright 2008.
All right.
Anyway, moving on. We got first preview of the Forge World Reaver Titan. This is the second tier Titan. The Imperials.
It depends on what they're going as by Titans, but yes.
Yes. Well,
just
because
Knight Titans are basically they're smaller than a Warhound, but that doesn't matter. Reaver Titans, okay.
Talk about Forge World ones. And they released a teaser image of the foot, which is, obviously bigger than a Space Marine, as they compare it next to. The toe is as big as a Space Marine. Some photos have started leaking out of the actual Titan itself, has appeared on a few forums and stuff like that. And they're showing off the complete model, showing off at the Forge World Open Day, which just happened recently. So they were showing off many pictures of that, and they actually had a large battle in which there was Imperial Guard tanks, and they had a Warhound Titan there, and then they also had the Reaver Titan in there, was absolutely massive.
Does it show a comparison to like a side-by-side of the Warhound versus the Reaver?
It was an actual battle that was going on, and there was a Warhound right next to it.
Oh, okay. Proportional and everything? I assume.
It is proportional, yeah. The Reaver Titan is take a Warhound Titan and add half on top of that. The size.
There goes $1,000 down the drain if you want that.
It's pretty big. Yeah, the gun on it, I'm not sure which one is Gatling, Mega Blaster, Heavy Assault, Vulcan Cannon.
Vulcan.
Of Doom! I was going to say, you have to add the Of Doom in there, otherwise
Of Doom.
It doesn't work as well, because Of Doom always makes everything sound
better. And, It was definitely really awesome, and the detail. If you've seen the original Reaver Titan from Epic 40,000, it's just like that, but just like the detail on it. There's on the actual one from Epic 40,000, the top shell was this big and curved, was normally just like a blank canvas, but on this one they have like a really fine, like intricate work of the Aquila and like ribbons and banners and stuff that fill up the entire top, and it's really, really nice, and it looks gorgeous when they painted it up from the Forge World team. So it definitely looks really good.
I wonder how the Chaos one will look. Hopefully they do a Chaos one. That'd be pretty cool.
Well, the same thing but spiky.
I'm also
spiky bits.
I'm wondering how it compares to the Titans for the other races. Just because the Tyranids have their Bio Titan, and they have the Titans for they have
this one. This one is the largest Titan out right now. Right. It does tower the Eldar and Tyranid one. So
okay, wonder if they're gonna put new ones of those.
It does look very nice. That's all I can say. So and also too, yeah, we're just talking about Forge World Open Day, and that just passed by, and fortunately we couldn't go because it's in Europe. Who would have thought? And at the Games Workshop HQ, but I think some of our members were heading to that, so hopefully we'll hear something from that.
And if we don't, and, shame on you.
Oh, shame. Our last news topic we're going to be talking about, there hasn't been too much going on, but we're still going to cover it, is the Warhammer, it's about Warhammer Online. There was a newsletter that came out, we're not going to talk about it because it is relatively old already, because we are a bit behind on this episode. We'll tell you why later. But the main thing we're going to be talking about is the collector's edition that they have previewed off. So, Chris, actually, do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, sure. Basically, it comes with a lot of really neat stuff. It's only in US dollars, the regular game is 50 and the collector's edition is 30. So it's only a, $80. It's only a $30 difference. My mistake. Don't be like, oh, collector's edition's cheaper. So, it's only a $30 difference, but it definitely seems well worth $30. You get an absolute ton of in-game stuff. I mean, you get invite to the open beta, the last one before the game actually ships. You get a code
of everything.
Yeah, basically there's 12 unique quests, two for each race. There's 12 unique heads for the races, one male, one female, unless you're orc, then there's just two random ones. You can when you play open beta, you can actually they give you a code that you can enter after you get the game that you actually get to keep your beta character, so you get a head start on everyone else. So instead of having
Are you sure that's how it worked? I thought it was 2 weeks before the release of the final game, you get to play ahead of everybody else.
I'm just reading this now. Double check.
I think it's...
But anyway, you get like 12
bonus
in-game
content.
Items or something and some other
yeah,
stuff.
12, yeah, 12 in-game bonus heads for additional character customization options. Each race has a truly distinctive look with male and female versions. Sure to turn heads on the battlefield. The envy of everyone's army. As a bonus, players who pre-order the collector's edition will receive 2 exclusive in-game items guaranteed access to the open beta and special early access to the live game.
Yeah, see, it's early access. You don't get to keep your beta one. You get basically 2 weeks beforehand, which is a good head start anyway, considering in 2 weeks
you know what to do.
Get up 10 or 20 levels maybe, depending on what the level cap is and how fast
and how much time you really devote to it.
Yep.
Or else you get a really badass orc model.
That orc head, the one with the metal plate covering the eye, looks really awesome.
I'm talking about the model.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the actual... Yeah, here's the thing. So it does come with a miniature. Very, very, very awesome miniature of... what's his name? Oh, Grumluck and Gazbag. Gazbag is the little goblin. I'm kind of like a shaman. This was his a staff. On the orc shoulder, and this orc, man, he's wearing, like, some big, bulky, heavy armor. And he looks really awesome, too. I love his axe, and it's got, like, the whole, it looks like lightning claw ordeal.
I wonder if...
Where he's got a blade attached to his arm, looks on his fist.
I wonder if they're gonna add a rule piece for him for, Warhammer Fantasy. I think that
I think he's just just a boss, perhaps.
Yeah,
but it would be sweet.
I think it's just
that would be. I really think it would be cool if they added a little rule set for him for Fantasy.
Yep.
Only 60,000 people will play him. Ha!
Original graphic novel that you get with it, an art book with the art of Warhammer Online, bonus in-game item, the Brims of Insight.
Yeah, and the books aren't small. They're like 128 pages or something like that.
Mm-hmm. The books are very... like the whole package is set really nice.
Isn't the graphic novel cover, too? Art book, it's hardcover, and you get a ton... like, the graphic novel is like 120-something pages or something like that, and the art book is just contains just pretty much all concept art and final art and stuff like that of the game. So, and I pre-ordered it about a week before I actually told my parents I bought it on their credit card, so...
I still have to pre-order it. That's,
by the way, I use your credit card, damn you.
Basically. But,
The books are very nice. If you know the Dungeons and Dragons books, sort of their manuals and stuff like that, how like very detailed the covers are, even though it's like a flat surface, it looks 3D.
Yeah.
That's the way these books are done. It's really, really nice. Like even the boxes are really nice. But it is a collector's edition that is well worth it. But again, with this collector's edition, there is some bad news. It's just to help ease the pain, and that is that Warhammer Online that was supposed to be released this spring has been delayed till fall of this year. So, a longer wait, yes, I know, there's always been those delays, we're all upset about it, but, you know, when you think about it in the end, a delayed game is a good game. So
I think it'd be a good game anyway. A delayed game is a better game.
Yes.
I think if they delay it one more time, there will be riots. And people will literally go to EA Mythic's office and just be like, okay, seriously, we're going to burn the place down in a second if you don't give us the game.
Every day, they just come in, and there's one more person standing in the parking lot. Accumulate. Like the Prince of Darkness movie.
Yeah. So yeah, that's it for news. Like, I'm a bit sad about that, but we'll manage. I think we'll manage. Some of us have already fallen for WoW, M. Gillies, but he's falling for WoW. Oh no, sorry, he went for EverQuest.
Yeah, EverQuest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he went for EverQuest. Steve fell for WoW. Wasn't Gillies falling for WoW or something like that, or was talking about it
or something like that? Then...
yeah, he's getting suckered in. Oh. I'm holding out strong. I think we're the only three that's holding out strong. We can wait, because we have a soul. But anyway, we're actually going to start rolling on to our next segment.
Just hold on. Just one more thing. The Fantasy Flight Games just on the
4th, right.
Put up their Dark Heresy page, just so you guys know that. You can get it off of the Fantasy Flight Games, which is fantasyflightgames.com. So go check that out. But I have to say that I'm not very impressed. But oh well.
Nope. Their website.
I wish they would have just used Black Industries' website, because it's so much better.
Yeah.
Oh, oh well.
The thing is, Tim, they don't care about you enough to have you make all
their
decisions.
Well, they should, because I am... not God, but close.
You don't like close grilled cheese. It. You can't be God.
Oh, yeah. There's a problem there.
I like cheese, though.
So, moving on to our next segment, we're rolling on to Unit of the Show.
For me, Sons of Sigma, for the Empire!
So, we are on to Unit of the Show. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the Lizardman Skinks. I'm a Lizardman player at heart, but we're just gonna give a little backstory on the Lizardmen. So actually, Tim, if you want to read that off, then we'll start going to the pros and cons of Skinks.
Skinks are a smaller race of Lizardmen, weaker and possessing less martial prowess than the large Saurus. They are more likely to fight with poison blowpipes or javelins than with hand-to-hand weapons. Sometimes, especially in the Southlands, Skinks also utilize shortbows. Generally, Skinks prefer, if forced to fight as skirmishers. If they form ranks in file regiments, they are often accompanied by Croxigobes. Skinks drive salamanders into battle, ride on terrifying pterodons, or on a
Pelequin.
Pelequin on the back of a giant Stagodon. Very special breeds of skinks are also called chameleon skinks, which are even sneakier than the average skink. Skinks were created by the old ones merely not for fighting, but to assist the Slann and work as architects, diplomats, interpreters, scribes, etc. Some skinks are gifted with magical powers and become skink shamans.
Yes. So, if you remember from the old Lizardman code, almost said it. Almost said it.
Jeff's going to have a field day with that one.
I was looking at the Dark Heresy page and I was thinking 40K. If you remember from the old Lizardman army book, that was a close call. They used to run the short bows, and you may even have some models like myself that have the short bows, which they do not use anymore, because they now switch to the new miniatures that use blowpipes or javelins. So it's you can still count the short bows as blowpipes, obviously. But anyway, let's start rolling on. We're going to go on with the pros and cons. Some major advantages to the skinks, and also it refers to Lizardmen in general, is the cold-blooded rule. And this is a really standout rule for the Lizardmen, because when taking any type of test that requires leadership value, they roll 3d6 instead of 2 as normal. They roll 3d6 and choose the two lowest values and discard the highest. So it gives you much greater chances of passing any sort of test. So again, it is really good for that, especially for fear tests or, again, anything that requires leadership. It really helps out, and like I said, the entire force uses this ability. Skirmishers. The skinks are skirmishers. Again, because you don't have to worry about ranking or, well, I guess when you do get into combat, you do have to worry about ranking, but no need for filing up, and especially when you're using the blowpipes, you don't have to worry about ranks that way. Good weapon choices. The blowpipe is a very effective weapon, regardless of what people say. Though it is short-ranged, at 12 inches, you do get it's 2 strength 3 shots out of it, and it does count as poisonous attack, so rolling any 6s to hit does cause a wound. So again, when you think about it in the end, when you do have skinks, you're going to be having mass amounts of them, so when you have, let's say, minimum 24, because that's what you get in a box, you get 24, you're looking at 48 poison blow dart shots. If you are within range of 12 inches, you're popping off 48 shots off that. 48 to hit dice. If you're getting any sixes on that, you're going to be causing some damage. And then you got your other rolls that were not sixes. They have a bliss skill 3. So any fours or higher, any four, fives, or sixes, you're getting a more rerolls to wound. So again, you're going to be getting a lot of good damage out of them, and they can hit the really heavy units pretty hard. And like I, back when I've played my Lizardmen, and back in the Storm of Chaos campaign, we had a tournament down at the hobby shop, and going to a squad of Chaos Warriors, you know, big heavy armor, stuff like that. I had all my skinks. I did critical damage to them, so they are very, very effective. Skinks are also aquatic, as are, I believe, almost all Lizardmen. The aquatic rule is really, it's mainly terrain-based. Normally, if you have any model that's going through terrain, such as swamps, bogs, rivers, any kind of water feature, there's like difficult terrain tests or movement deductions that you have to worry about. Lizardmen completely ignore that rule because they are aquatic, so they swim through it really fast. The scout rule. Skinks are scouts, so they're able to use the deployment rules, deploy off the table edge, anything like that. They're able to infiltrate. And also, because of the skinks, they're able, if they're deployed within a water feature, or if they're deployed within a water feature, when you start the game, they count as being out of sight. So as soon as you start a nice little pond or river or anything like that, enemies not able to target you whatsoever, and you could be like right in front of their face. So another really good rule about the skinks. And also, I was referring back to the Croxagores. Croxagores can be used as support. So when you do have a Croxagore in your unit, you are losing the whole skirmish ability, because then that's where you file up. But again, when you're having one in there, it's a great backup to have in case if you get into combat, you have a Croxagore to help deal all the damage, because skinks are not exactly close combat melee fighters. So, and also the Croxagore can leave the unit and charge into combat and then do whatever you want with your skinks. Now we go on to the cons. Here's the thing with the skinks is that there's more pros than cons that I find. But cons, yeah, not the strongest unit in the game. Statistically, they're pretty weak. Toughness of 2, obviously 1 wound, stuff like that. You can give them shields if you want to. Doesn't add too much. And then initiative 4, stuff like that. I'm not going to read off all the stats. But again, they're all right. They're what you get for really cheap core infantry for your army. But they're mainly short ranged, and that's where they're very effective. And they're very maneuverable, so you can get around that. And one other thing that I kind of found about them is that you do need large amounts of them to be effective with them. Having a little unit of just a handful is not going to do as much damage as a full unit of, let's say, 24 plus or 48 plus. If you just go for the minimum, or not 48 plus, sorry, but if you go for the minimum unit size of 10, you may not do that much, because that unit is going to be chopped down pretty quickly because of their low stats. You're going to looking at 25 per unit, and then if you take a few units of that, maybe for 50, 75, because they're very cheap, 6 points a model, and they automatically come with hand weapon and blowpipe, and all these lovely special rules. It is worth to get a mass amount of them, because they are very effective. So that's really your cons of the skinks. There could be a few more, but those are the really the standout ones that that we notice.
I have a question about the skinks. Do they get the scaly skin rule?
No, they don't. They do not have scaly skin, so they are not getting their lovely save as Ella the Source Warriors. But even still, that's what they have their shields for. But shields and javelins, whatever. I just stick with the blowpipes. it's not really worth it for like the 6+ save. Just go with the blowpipes. But anyway, Chris, actually, you want to read off the little tactica there for that?
Sure. This is one of the user tips. It says skinks are a fantastic core unit. Should easily be in any Lizardmen army. The fast movement and the great poison attacks make them a deadly unit. With the added special rule of being aquatic, make them move through water and marshes that would otherwise bog down other units. The added ability of being scouts makes them strike faster into the enemy. If deployed within a water feature, they count as being out of sight and cannot be targeted. Blowpipes are a deadly weapon. Having a mass unit of skinks will increase the amount of shots put out. 2x shots per skink. Plus being poisonous, meaning that even very tough units can be hit very hard. The downfall of the skinks, however, are weak stat-wise. Putting them in combat is a way to lock up enemies, but they won't last long. Keep them at range. Use the terrain to your advantage.
Yep. And again, that is the thing with the skinks. Since they are the skirmishers, very, very maneuverable. They're a facile unit. Get them into water features, or even into, especially water. If you can get them into water, stuff like that, lure the enemy into them, be really good.
Can they shoot from water?
Yeah.
They just can't be shot at when they're in water.
If deployed within a water feature, they count as being out of sight. So that's one advantage of them. So no one can be like, pop them off. They just swim right under.
Sweet. That'd be awesome if you just use them almost like a turret.
Pop, pop, shoot, swim under. So actually, Tim, do you want to read off the little listener tip that we got sent in?
Hey guys, a skirmish, screen rule for the Croxagore is great. The ability to have a Croxagore join a unit of skinks adds that needed support in case of accidental close combat, but also making both units independent so you can have the Croxagore leave as many times to charge into combat while your skinks are stay behind. There have been a few instances where I have where I have my Croxagore save my precious skinks, where you should charge. Okay, that doesn't sound right, but badly damage the enemy unit. They have my skinks go in for finisher. Hope this helps. Keep up the fantastic work. Dave Kular.
All right, so again, like we were talking about the skirmish screen. The skirmish screen, sorry, that is the ability for Croxagores to be implemented into the skink unit. And when, when in there, they have the ability to, they get filed up, Croxagores goes into the back rank. But also, too, like I said, the Croxagore has the ability to leave the unit. You do your, I believe, let me double check on this, I believe it was a leadership test.
Just a question. What does the Croxagore do for the skinks rank and file?
What do you mean?
Does it give them any bonuses or anything?
No, he just has the ability to be like a support unit within the unit.
Okay.
Because normally you can have the Croxagores independently or in a unit of three, because normally, you know, they can be in there just to be like the big hulking support in case of anything like that. That's their reasoning.
They're kind
of
like
so. yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
The Croxagores are the equivalent of a rat ogre. So yeah, basically, when you have the Croxagore in the unit, you take a leadership test. If you pass, the Croxagore can freely leave the unit, charge into combat, do its own thing while the skinks can stay behind, thus being two separate units. If failed, though, basically when the Croxagore is charging, he runs into a few skinks, steps on them, that sort of thing, and it doesn't. They're not able to do anything that turn because there's a bit of a big mess that just happened. Perhaps he tripped. Perhaps he squished a few of the little skink buddies.
Yes, to pull them out between his toes.
Yeah, and hurts to walk, that sort of thing. So. Yeah, so again, Dave Kohler's got the idea there, I don't do this person myself, though I have tried the skirmish screen before, and it is pretty effective, but I like to have my Croxagores in their own unit, doing their own thing, instead of in with the skinks, though, like I said, they are good support for that. It depends on what the enemy's got. You can probably work around that. So on next episode, we are going to be talking about the 40k Dark Eldar Warriors. So if you have any tips, tricks on this unit, send them into mwunion@gmail.com. So that was it for the Lizardmen Skinks. Like I said, I love my Lizzymen. So we'll definitely be talking about them more in the future. One of those undervalued army, in my opinion. Not many people play them. So we're actually going to, here's a, kind of the awkward transition of the show. We have a special feature that we're going to be doing, and that is we're going to be doing a retrospective, talk about celebrating the 25 years of Warhammer, this year's being the 25th anniversary of the hobby. And because it's relatively long, we're going to be breaking it into two parts. Part one is going to be aired on this episode. But instead of us just reading it off, it's actually going to be a video feature that is played on our website. So probably by the time you hear this, it'll be up and running. If not, just wait a little bit, it'll be up. But on today's episode, we're going to be playing it in audio form, so you can just imagine the pictures in your head. And we're going to be playing part one of two. Part two we'll be playing on next episode, but we're going to be playing that after the show's over. So right now, we're going to move on to listener feedback, and when we're done wrapping up, we're going to play the part one of the Warhammer retrospective. So, like I said, moving on right now, we're going to go on to listener feedback. We're just going to swap through the questions, so Chris, you can start us off, then Tim, then me, and then rinse and repeat.
Okay. The first comment is from Mitch from the forums. He said, I would just like to say that I love the podcast and keep up the great work.
Thank you. I love you too, Mitch.
From John Doherty. I think that's how you say it. Hey, guys.
Yes.
Hey, guys. With Fantasy Flight Games taking over the Black Industries, do you know if Warhammer Quests and Space Hulk will be coming back?
They already confirmed no. They are not taking care of that. Fantasy Flight Games did not get the rights to those games. They got the rights to the role-playing games and not the not Space Hulk and Warhammer Quest.
Didn't they get card games as well?
No, card games are managed by Sabretooth.
Okay, I thought that somewhere I heard that they switched from Sabretooth over to Fantasy Flight Games. I guess not.
No, Sabretooth's still around. Fantasy Flight Games just got the role-playing stuff. But they didn't pick up any of the rights to Space Hulk or Warhammer Quest. Though a new Space Hulk would be pretty sweet. I would love Space Hulk 2.0. all right, so we're going to the next one here from Jake Carson. Hey, DPC crew. I seem to find us around. Why does it seem that Warhammer players, both 40K and Fantasy, seem not to be interested in the video games based on them? Whenever I talk to some 40K players about Dawn of War 2, they seem not to care as much. I find this odd because it's something quite fantastic and adds a level of immersion that the tabletop cannot produce. Being able to see units move and fire as if it was a real thing is something to behold. Why is this so? Thanks and keep the episodes rolling.
They have a stick up their bum. That's why.
Yeah, we kind of noticed it too with the show. There's been people saying, you know, like, oh, we don't, when we talk about the games like Dawn of War, Warhammer Online, like, yeah, don't care about that. Like, why? I think that's really awesome to see, you know, Warhammer in action like that, because obviously we're not getting a movie or anything, but just the fact that you can control this stuff as if it were real life. Like, when Dawn of War came out, that was the closest thing we got to a virtual version of the tabletop game. So it's, and, you know, when you get into some of the other stuff, unfortunately, Fire Warrior, but yeah. You take the role of it, you know, in first person game, it was nice you got to take a test drive of like a bolter and pulse rifle and stuff like that. You know, that was really cool. So, yeah, I don't see why there's people that are, they're not against it, but they just don't have any care for it. I don't know why. It's quite odd in my opinion.
I think a Dawn of War 2 turn-based mod would be pretty cool to make it even
just like a
tabletop.
A tabletop mod for that? That's something I would like to do for the first Dawn of War, but wait up for two. It'd be pretty sweet. It'd be really nice to do. Mm-hmm. Be like a virtual way to play the tabletop game online. So, alright, Chris.
Okay, it says, gentlemen, I would like to say you guys are doing a fantastic job on the podcast. Episode 41 was great with having Spencer from 40K Radio.
I said thank you.
Oh. Will we see Jeff from Podhammer on the Drop Podcast and vice versa? I just think it's really cool how you guys are all linked together through your site, which, by the way, is another thing I wanted to thank you guys for. The MW Union has become a big part of my daily computer usage. You've done a great job and keeps getting better. Thanks to you guys for making the hobby better. Ted Williams.
Thanks, Ted. Yeah, like, again, you know, we had Spencer for 40K Radio on the show. Jeff. Jeff, sorry. Sorry, Jeff, didn't mean to insult you.
I'll kill you.
Ooh.
That's a bird.
Jeff will be definitely coming on the show. Actually, we do have something planned. I'm not going to be talking about it yet, but we do have something up our sleeve. But you'll definitely be seeing a lot of crossovers happening because, we're all friends and we all, love the hobby and love podcasting, so you'll definitely see lots of crossovers. So, yeah, just all I can say is stay tuned. You may see something very soon that will be pretty fun. Tim.
Hey, guys. Great job with the podcast. Getting a bit orky there, I guess. Just a quick question about tournaments. What is a good way to find out about tournaments in my area? I would like to start playing tourneys more, but I just don't know where they are. Thanks, Lancelot 005.
That's what we do in the forums. So tournaments. It really depends on your area. I would probably say look for local hobby shops. See what they run. It depends, like, are you wanting to do official tournaments or just independently run tournaments, that sort of thing. If you're looking for anything, look for hobby shops, see what you have nearby first.
Even official tournaments. I know there's one every once in a really great while here, but they're all done at the hobby shop, the local hobby shop. So,
yeah.
So I think that's the best place to look.
Also,
go ahead.
I was going to say, also sometimes on, I haven't checked it out recently, but I think sometimes if you go to like Games Workshop's Warhammer.com or whatever country you're from, I think sometimes they'll list the hobby shops nearby, and I think sometimes they'll actually list like tournaments or special events going on at those specific hobby shops.
I think that might actually, I know what you're talking about, but I think that might actually only be for Game Workshop stores, just their own shops.
If you look, actually it depends on which one. I'm only using the Canadian site. I know it's on there. But you can actually look for hobby shops, or it's under the community section. You can actually look for hobby shops or gaming clubs that nearby, and actually they'll list tournaments
just
on there as well.
I know I looked at that quite a while back, and all that they had around me was the Games Workshop's hobby shops, and well, there's none around. So
yeah, I'm just gonna check on right now on the community website. Events calendar. Well, that's for the main events. Community. Yeah, I know. They had something on there. I'm not gonna spend time looking around it now. But yeah, just look around the Games Workshop. So if you're from America, I know they list it probably better on there than the other ones. But just
if you
look.
Oh, go ahead.
Also, just look. Like I said, even local gaming clubs and hobby shops will definitely run stuff, and they'll list, if it's not listed on there, just see what you have nearby for a hobby shop and ask them if they have anything running or if they're interested in planning something, because a lot of places don't do anything because maybe they don't know about the interest, that sort of thing.
I was going to say, on the if you go on the U.S. Games Workshop site, if you're from the U.S., if you go to events and then event calendar, there's a... It says independent retailers, and it gives you, it says like GW Hobby Centers, independent retailers, and Rogue Trader tournaments. And it'll give you like April, March of 2008, which is obviously over April 2008. And then I guess when May comes around, it'll go to May 2008, and it'll list all the, like I see here, like there's one in Georgia where it specifically says that it's a Warhammer tournament, and it gives a short description, a website, or a contact, phone numbers. Stuff like that. So if you're from America, check that out. Also, check out on your, if you're not, you can go to your Warhammer.com page, find events, find calendar events or event calendar or something like that, and check it out.
See, I'm actually on the Canadian site now. I found the page. Here we go. Club listing. Here we go. So I found the gaming club listing. This is for Canada, if you're looking for that. And it's under the community page. It's under Regiment... What is it under? Regiments of Renown? Yeah, under Regiments of Renown. And it'll list it by province, and then it'll show We'll go to Ontario, for example. Is there anything in my town? No. Oh, yeah, there's one. Well, it says Simcoe. That's got to be me, I'm assuming. But anyway, so it'll be the Holy Trinity Club. And the game systems they run are 40K strictly, and they have 5 active members. But if we'll see the most active one. I see 40. So, okay, yeah. We're looking at 40 here. The Central Town Club in Ottawa. They do Fantasy, 40K, Mordheim, Battlefield Gothic. There's another one here. The Hammers of the North, that's in Toronto. Does Fantasy, 40K, Lord of the Rings, Battlefield Gothic. You know, 40 members, stuff like that. So, yeah, and they lost off active members. And I'm pretty sure they run tournaments and stuff like that. But also, you can also look in the White Dwarf, because they list, or I'm not, they used to, when we used to get the American one in Canada here, it used to come with a little pamphlet that listed all the hobby shops, and it listed tournaments that are coming up for them. And we don't get that now, because we have our own White Dwarf, and for some reason they stopped listing that, but check into that if that's something else you want to look into. You may find some more information there.
I think that's kind of funny, the Holy Trinity one. How can you play Warhammer 40K in a church? They just pull Jesus on you, and then you always lose. Jesus poons all. Come on. It's like, damn it, I lost again. What? How'd he win? And I pulled the Jesus on me.
All right, and we're going to get to our last question. And this one here is pretty damn serious. This comes from Davey C, and probably the most serious man I know. And he's become really known on our website for some serious issues. And he writes to us saying, guys, this is another critical question in which has been driving me mad not being able to determine the answer. You guys can understand and probably help me. It is a question the man himself has been pondering for many years. Who would win in an epic beyond all belief fight? Skeletor or Cobra Commander? Please save my sanity. Davey C.
Skeletor, obviously, considering not even He-Man can take him down.
Depends which Skeletor are we talking about. We talk about the first generation Skeletor, or like the new crap that's on TV, or animated movies.
Either way, I still go with Skeletor.
Hard to say. If it's I may say if it's the original Cobra Commander that had like the bubble shield helmet.
Yeah, but see Cobra Commander is also a snake, so couldn't you just poison Skeletor? Then again, Skeletor is a skeleton and therefore probably dead, so how could he die from the poison? But then Skeletor can't be defeated by He-Man, so he's
But Cobra Commander has minions, though.
Ah, screw that. So does
Skeletor. And he's got the Baroness.
Skeletor like... has minions.
Oh, what does Skeletor have? Panthor?
Minions don't freaking do anything. Considering Skeletor and Cobra Commander, both of their minions always get the crap beaten out of them all the time by the good guys. So it's just kind of like, okay.
It was same with Skeletor though. Like Skeletor, whenever He-Man does something, Skeletor always loses and ends up going back to.
So does Cobra Commander.
Yes, but it's always like that. That's what happens in shows of that era.
Think you guys are always weird. I know there's a teacher in our school that we nicknamed Skeletor.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I'm so tempted to walk into school one day with a plastic score, just go up to her and go, I have the power, and whack her and run away.
I have the power!
Then again, she's the track coach, so she could probably catch me.
Possibly. And then I say, okay, if it's Skeletor, if it's the original Skeletor, and if he has Panthor with him, and if it was the original Cobra Commander with the minions and Baroness, ooh, that's a toughie. I'm probably gonna say Cobra Commander.
Doesn't Skeletor have magic powers though, or some shit like that?
I'm going with Skeletor.
I'm going with Cobra Commander.
I think 2-1 Skeletor wins just because he has a skull.
Oh, yeah, but Cobra Commander has that sweet.
He
little,
has a skull for a head.
Yeah, really. Yeah, come on. You don't mess.
A skull, Steve! A skull!
Yeah, but Cobra Commander has that sweet little chair ship, remember? that little that little ship he has.
But Skeletor has a freaking castle with a skull on it. A skull, yeah. Steve. A skull.
But Commander has like a submarine base, like.
But not a skull castle.
The no, skull but castle it is better than a skull castle. Cobra Commander had everything. It has like spaceships and laser cannons. You don't see a friggin' Skeletor with laser cannons.
He has his kitty to do all his laser cannon defense work. Yeah, his Skeletor what? Has dude. Laser cannons inside the.
And he has a skull.
Inside
a skull, Steve. A skull.
Castle. He has laser cannons. Haven't you ever played with a playset?
Oh yeah, that's right.
See, he has laser cannons too.
Oh yeah, you can get that attachment for Panther or whatnot.
And that has a laser same thing with cannon as well.
Was it Wildcat or one of the green cat
yeah,
he had?
No, that's
you can get like the little cannons for the side.
yeah. Skeletor
comes
has
down to who has a skull
side and laser cannons. Cobra Commander only has laser cannons, and
I think yeah,
they're friggin' huge laser cannons really, on a submarine ship.
Skeletor has
space.
Huge laser cannons in his skull castle.
Okay, okay, fine, fine, fine. I still say Cobra Commander, but we'll give the victory to Skeletor, because it's 2-1.
And he has skulls.
Yeah.
Laser cannons. And Baroness. Come on.
Skulls. Skulls. Game over.
You don't have,
set,
you don't have,
you win. Touchdown.
You don't have a you don't have a sexy minion. And you can't count She-Ra or whatnot.
Yeah, that freaky lady does not count.
Baroness.
What if what if Skeletor seduces Baroness? Because yeah, you can't just ignore the Skull Man. Sexy.
Yes.
And then he can light it on fire and become Ghost Rider, and then he just kicks. seriously.
And
then his cat turns into
happen.
Some bone thingy-ma-jew with flames and shit.
Yes.
No, his cat becomes
fine.
A smoke
okay, okay. And end of combo. Well, Skeletor takes the victory 2-1. So there you go, Davey C. I try to stick up for Cobra Commander, but I
power of the
better
prevail.
Over.
Yes. So we're gonna say Skeletor wins by a slight hairline.
There's only three of us. There's no slight hairline. It's 3-1.
It's 2-1. We win.
So
Skeletor
this is
wins.
A landslide.
No.
It's a half
hair.
Slide. A half-ass slide.
No, a yeah. Hair would be if it was like 3-2. This is 2-1.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure we need
okay.
To wrap up. Shut up.
Let's wrap up this show. So if you have any questions, comments, or army list, send them into mwunion@gmail.com. Or if you want to send in who will win, Skeletor or Cobra Commander. If you want to send in your victories for Cobra Commander, send them into mwunion@gmail.com.
And if you want to vote for Skeletor, send them to the same place.
Yeah. Also, be sure to join us at the Miniatures Wargaming Union, our Games Workshop news site, at mwunion.com. I was supposed to say at Gmail, but no, at mwunion.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Draw Podcast on iTunes, and be nice and leave us a review. Helps us. And also, be sure to check out our other podcasts that we have. We have Podhammer, 40K Radio, which just joined us recently, and the slightly delayed again Forge, which will be coming soon, we swear. We'll get to that. Anyways, I want to thank Tim and Chris for joining us on this episode.
Even though they're cruel bastards, don't agree with you on Cobra Commander's winning.
Whatever. again, you guys, we're going to be, right now, if we were going to play the end here, because it's going to be an optional thing. You don't have to listen to it if you don't want to, because it's better to watch the video when we have it on our website.
Yeah, but if you don't listen to it, we'll put you down and hurt you.
Yes. But if you're too lazy, then you can listen to it here. So we're going to start playing part one of our Warhammer retrospective. So again, guys, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time right here on the Draw Podcast.
Back before, it was building mass armies of mighty warriors. A little-known UK-based company named Games Workshop opened its doors in 1975. Founded by Ian Livingston and Steve Jackson, Games Workshop was originally a manufacturer of wooden board games such as Backgammon and chess, which later became an importer of the US role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. Under the direction of Livingston and Jackson, Games Workshop expanded from being a bedroom mail-order company to a successful gaming publisher and manufacturer. An early promotional magazine, Alan Weasel, was supersedded in June 1977, partially to advertise the opening of the first Games Workshop store by the gaming magazine White Dwarf, which Livingston also edited. Their publishing arm also created UK reprints of famous but expensive-to-import American role-playing games such as Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, Traveller, and Middle-Earth role-playing. In 1979, Games Workshop provided the funding to help found Citadel Miniatures in Newark, a company that would produce metal miniatures that were used in role-playing and tabletop war games. The Citadel name has become synonymous with Games Workshop miniatures and continues to be a trademark brand name used in association with them long after a Citadel company was absorbed into Games Workshop. Dungeons & Dragons was a hit game, and many fanatics would collect hundreds upon hundreds of miniatures from the game that represented characters and monsters. It wasn't until realization of the hobby where a game with so many miniatures, yet only a few can be used at a time. The idea of taking the collected miniatures from the D&D game and placing them on the battlefield in massive armies, getting use of all the miniatures. This is where the concept for Warhammer was born. The first edition, written by Brian Ansel, Richard Halliwell, and Rick Priestley, was published in 1983, and consisted of a box set of three black and white books illustrated by Tony Ackland. Volume 1, Tabletop Battles, which contained the core rules, turn sequence, creature lists, and features an introductory battle, the Ziggurat of Doom. Volume 2, Magic, which explains the rules for wizards of four different levels. Higher level wizards have access to more powerful spells. In this system, a wizard picks a spell at the start of the game, must have the correct equipment, usually amulets, and as he casts one, it depletes his store number of constitution points. Until 0 points, he can cast no more. Volume 3, Characters, introduces personal characteristic statistics, rules for role-playing, including character advancement through the experience points and statistic gains, random encounters, equipment costs, and alignment, and has a sample campaign, the Red Wake River Valley. Very little world background is given at all, and race descriptions are kept to a minimum. Most of the background is given to describing the origins of magic items. Some notable differences in later editions are the inclusion of Night Elves, known today as the Dark Elves, and the appearance of the Red Goblins, and that Citadel Order codes are given. Despite many rule inconsistencies, inadequate role-playing rules, typing errors, and poor presentation, the battle system was thought to be excellent and exceptionally simple and playable in comparison to the other miniature games of the time. The psychology rules for determining how classic fantasy racial types behave towards each other and fumbling over magic were well regarded and thought to enhance the fantasy feel of the game and provide entertainment. In 1984, the second edition of Warhammer was released, incorporating some of the Forces of Fantasy material, White Dwarf articles, and Citadel Compendium material. Also released in a box set of three black and white books, just like first edition. Combat explains the core rules in turn sequence. Battle magic, which largely retains the system as in first edition, as well as adding specialties of illusionists, demologists, elementalists, and removing the requirements for amulets. The center pages are an introductory scenario, the Magnificent Sven, for which cardstock figures were also supplied in the box. The Battle Bestiary books features descriptions of races, monsters, and includes several example army lists and point systems for players to develop their own open-ended armies. Also in the Battle Bestiary is a first appearance of the Warhammer known world, along with a map, a timeline which includes the Slann, Insurgents of Chaos, Inter-Elf Wars, and the Empire. Minor rule modifications including rationalizing all statistics to use numbers and increasing all creatures' strength by +1. In 1985, the first campaign packs were produced, Terror of the Lichmaster and Bloodbath at Orc's Drift. In 1986, Tragedy of Macbeth and the pack of Blood on the Streets card buildings for terrain were released. In 1987, the second edition rules were expanded with the Ravening Horde's army list, which provided a more realistic method of forming armies along with stricter racial lines. The Warhammer Fantasy Battles setting led to Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay in 1986, a spin-off of Warhammer Fantasy going back to the D&D roots of straight roleplaying. The game was such a big hit in the UK that it eventually became the preferred roleplaying game over Dungeons & Dragons. The third edition of the game was published as a single hardback book in 1987. It had the most in-depth and complex movement and maneuver system of any edition. Other improvements included a variety of new special troop types, rules for war machines, and a more finely tuned system for representing heroes and wizards. It kept the same magic system and open-ended army design as the first two editions. However, by this stage, the use of army lists was very much encouraged. Army lists for this edition were published in a separate book called Warhammer Armies in 1991. Until then, the use of second edition's Ravening Hordes list was encouraged. The third edition is fondly remembered by its longtime fans of the game, in spite of its somewhat cumbersome rules and long play time. This is partly because it was the last edition published before Games Workshop took a more commercial approach, leading to competition from former Games Workshop employees in the briefly published competing Fantasy Warlord. The third edition was expanded with the Realm of Chaos and Warhammer Siege books. The first edition of Blood Bowl, the third specialist game set in the Warhammer universe, uses a basic turn system to simulate a fantasy American football game. Rules for the ranged combat and magic are omitted, in addition to special dice are required to play. A science fiction-based skirmish war game using similar rules was developed as Warhammer 40,000 by Games Workshop and released in 1987. Originally using minor variation of the second edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle rules, the two games have subsequently taken different development paths. Stay tuned till next week as we finish off with part 2 of our Warhammer retrospective, celebrating 25 years of Warhammer.